Hello again, it's Patrick Kelly with Airtime, the official podcast of the Olympic Styles of USA Wrestling Kansas. It's Fargo Week. The culmination of months of training and competition for freestyle and Greco has come to this. Team Kansas boards the charter bus tomorrow morning for stops at Legends of Gold in South Dakota before heading north on Thursday morning for Fargo and the national tournament. We have a special guest on the program today to mark the occasion. Award-winning wrestling journalist Jason Bryan is on the line. Jason has done some unique and really groundbreaking projects to inform, enlighten, and entertain the wrestling community with his podcast network and has become the voice of wrestling throughout the world with the many events that he has been on the mic for. Jason, welcome to the program. It's an honor and privilege to have you.
That's good. Good to be back. Good to be back. And I'll be back in Kansas this year as Wichita be hosting the NAIA Championships again. So super happy to be in the wonderful state of Kansas where I can go to Fargo and make fun of Randy Hinterleiter till there's no end.
Okay. All right. So we had you on about a year ago before Fargo. I think it was early July. So catch us up to speed with the events that you've worked since then and with the projects that you've been working on.
You know, the Mad Talk Podcast Network is a very robust on-demand audio network. It's the largest audio on-demand wrestling network in the world for that type of content. You know, you've got flow with all the video. Well, I've got the audio content. We got 25 to 30 podcasts, depending on what you want to listen to, how you want to listen to it, on the network at madtalkonline.com. But some of the things I've been doing, a lot of historical research in terms of aggregating and archiving. You know, right now I'm just finishing up the NJCAA record book. You know, their records are kind of hit or miss, and that's kind of relevant for Kansas because they're adding a lot of junior college programs, and there's been some really good junior college programs, past and present, that have a lot of history and a lot of native Kansans wrestling. You know, their names are out there in the record books, and I'm going through seeing all these towns and such. So it's kind of a history lesson for me to put some names with faces and coming across with, you know, looking about what happened to Garden City back in the day. That was one of the powerhouse junior college programs back in the 90s. I had a buddy that wrestled for them, actually a couple friends that wrestled for them back in the day. And then seeing what, you know, looking at through the dates when Muzaffar Abdurakhmanov and Gambai Arsanja come through Colby and what Steve Lampe had done there. So, and now we're seeing, you know, the NAIA really blossom in Kansas. So a lot of that research that I've been doing is tied into this very show here. So you like how I tied all that
together? Absolutely, yeah.
But, yeah. You know, there's that research. And then I've launched a program with the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, which is starting a Division I wrestling program this fall. They announced a hire of Neil Erisman earlier last year. They announced they were adding a program at the 2018 NCAA Championship. So that program is called Rocked Up. And what's interesting about that program is it's unlike any other show on the network. If you've listened to a lot of my stuff and if you listen to a lot of my stuff, you hear me a lot, but you hear a lot of interviews. This is unlike any other program I've ever done. So if you're a podcast listener and you've heard shows like Reply All and Serial and things that go into storytelling, that is what I've kind of jumped into with this Little Rock show. Because many of you know Arkansas did not have high school wrestling 10 years ago. And if you didn't know that, there's a unique story about how the fundamental foundations of high school wrestling ultimately led to a college program at Wachita Baptist, a Division II school, which ultimately led to more NAIA programs, which ultimately led to Little Rock starting the first Division I wrestling program in the state and the first major college to have wrestling since the 1950s. Because at the time in the 50s, you know, Harold Nichols, who many might know as a longtime legendary coach at Iowa State, he actually started a program at Arkansas State back in the 50s, and it only lasted a very short time, and that was really before we had divisions, a Division I, Division II, Division III, et cetera. So hence I use the term major college and not Division I. But you know, that's a lot. What a lot of this summer is doing is opening my eyes on research, flipping through old pages of amateur wrestling news, updating the Fargo Almanac. And you know, I do a lot less shows in the summertime where this is really my all right, let's see what I can learn. So those are the projects since pretty much the last time. You know, Little Rock is the big one. We've added some different shows. I'm working with Track Wrestling on a couple of their initiatives, like the Countdown to Nur Sultan, where I narrate their short little, you know, bang-bang nuggets that profile 100 different athletes leading into the 2009 Senior World Championship. So I figured, all right, I've got some ideas that I want to do with some narration of some old storytelling stuff. And I figured that one was a good shot because they're quick, 2 minute episodes. And You know, if you need a primer for the World Championships, you can just listen to and binge them all right away. I mean, we're about, I guess we're 25 or 26 episodes into that one, and that will culminate with episode one as we blow the first whistle in Kazakhstan this year.
Yeah, yeah, good stuff. And, you know, you talk about a Kansas connection, you know, with the Little Rock program, with Neil Ehrsman being from DeSoto, and then the team of one, Connor Ward, being in that same school district at Mill Valley. You know, that's really something that Kansans are really, really tuned into. And that show is very well done and very, very interesting. I could not wait until the next episodes come out. So very, very well done.
And one thing, too, is it's a lot more labor-intensive in putting something together like that, because I went down to Little Rock in December and recorded 8 or 9 different interviews, and here we are, you know, in July, you know, 6, 7, 8 months later, and I'm still working on stuff and putting things together, not necessarily because, you know, that's how long it takes. Well, you know, there are other things on the plate. So, you know, sometimes it takes a good week and a half, 2 weeks to actually put a single episode together. When you pull all the files out, you're like, okay, you go back, you re-listen to them, you tag them, and you're like, okay, where does this fit in with this? Where does this fit in with this? And a lot of the editing process, I had a show, episode 3 I put out, it was initially about 38 minutes long, and I start there and I start listening to it. And, you know, believe it or not, my wife's not a wrestling person, so she provides a listener aspect that, you know, from somebody's like that's listening to the story for the first time and going, I think this is unnecessary. And I'm like, and I look at it from a different perspective. I'm like, you know what? Yeah, that's a little too inside baseball, because the idea with the Little Rock show is for wrestling people, but it's also to tell a story that's never been told before. And maybe have that allure to a non-wrestling audience. Maybe it's a sports fan. Maybe it's just somebody who likes serialized stories or things like that. So that's one thing that I've learned with this process is it's a little more labor intensive than I initially planned. You know, I'm a high volume podcaster. I mean, I'm putting out, you know, 30 to 40 episodes a month on the network. So you're probably going to get a new show daily if you subscribe to the master feed. And, you know, tie that into the research, tie that into the announcing. I'm, like you said, I've been announcing events too. Of course, that's one place where I've definitely kind of earned my stripes a little bit. Is, you know, I did the World Championships last year in Budapest again. I did the television for the Asian Championships in Xi'an, China, and I had both Final X events. So I will not be on the microphone in Fargo, because it's more of a, you know, there's, you know, you spend a week in Fargo. You know how many interviews and stuff, you know, great content you get from there. So I basically sit there, pop the microphones up at the media table, maybe even do some post-event shows. I'm thinking about doing something with Willie at Flow. And, you know, every couple nights we'll do a live, you know, recap show of what's going on. So a lot of things going on in Fargo, but usually there's a microphone around me in you know, some way.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great, great stuff. Great stuff. You know, and back to the research that you're doing on the junior college, it's interesting little nuggets come out of it too, not just the people and places and programs, but you know, you talk about Garden City and you think about Coach Lean and then, you know, where he went after, but also just the way they assign the All-Americans. Historically, it was 5 All-Americans, I think. You kind of explained it in one of your recent programs, but that kind of stuff is really interesting too.
Yeah, to break that out, I'll just kind of give that explanation real quick. So the NJCAA, National Junior College Athletic Association, has had a national tournament officially sanctioned since 1968. Prior to that, it was what was an invitational. So 1960 through 1967, it's kind of like what we're seeing with the NAIA women right now. They had an invitational this year. It was technically not considered a national championship.
Jamestown, sure, yeah.
Yeah, even though you know, I think it's safe to say that those athletes are all Americans. You know, so with the NJCAA, it started back where there were, you know, the tournament was in its early days and there was maybe 8 to 12 teams or something like that. You weren't having a very robust collection of teams, and that was just the top 3. And up till 1974, it was just top 3 were considered all American. Then 75 through 77, they went to top 4. Then they started placing top 6, and then top 6 were All-Americans, and then top 8 through 95. But in 96, from what I understand, the NJCAA said there were too many All-Americans based on how many people were qualifying for the tournament. And, you know, logically that makes sense. If you've got a 16-man bracket and half your wrestlers are All-Americans, you know, what's the value in an All-American? I think that, you know, personally, I think in any bracket that's a 32-man bracket, you should place 8. Those should be All-Americans. But right now, from 1996 through the present day, the NJCAA only officially says that the top 5 place winners are all Americans. Now, there is a note that the NWCA and through some of the work that Ron Mercatani, the longtime coach at what used to be the program at St. Louis Community College Merrimack, it basically said, okay, 6, 7, and 8, you're going to get an All-American certificate, but this time it's from the NWCA, and I believe that's something they've continued through. So there are, believe it or not, there are some 7th and 8th placers out there that said, yeah, I was an All-American. Well, if it was after 96, technically you weren't, but technically you were. So that's kind of one of those gray areas.
Yeah.
It's really kind of like, yeah, my buddy's All-American, he plays 7th, and I'm just like, I'm not going to shoot you down on this one right now. I'm just going to it's going to let it go, because sometimes you don't want to be the jerk that says, well, actually, and I've been that jerk that's gone, well, actually, and sometimes that doesn't always end well. But, you know, that's just a unique thing about the junior colleges. And what I have actually done is I had all those All-Americans initially, but then I've gone through and, you know, this old educator from suburban Chicago in the Wheaton area, Ed Ewalt, and he's been a advocate for small college wrestling. I think he's actually in the Junior College Hall of Fame as a contributor. He had these old binders that he dropped off with Kyle Klingman when Kyle was with the Gable Museum, and they had every place winner from like all these small colleges, all these tournaments. And I'm like, the old engine going back from the college and university divisions before there was Division I, Division II, and Division III, and had hometowns. And it has been a treasure trove of information that has never been digitized.
Wow.
So I'm going these records and I'm looking at the record book, and there are some situations where the record book in the NJCAA has the wrong champion. You know, there's things like, and I'm like, I'm going back and then I'm trying to cross-reference it. And like, you know, it's strange to know that, okay, well, that guy is listed here as 4th place where he's at the wrong way. It's just so many different ways to correct things. And that's the one thing when you collect all the stuff from information, because we were not an information age prior to, you know, 1997. So, you know, that's really kind of where the beginnings of stats on the internet begins is 20 some years ago, but it's, you know, even more prevalent now with track and Flow Arena and things like that, where a lot of those results are online for longer than just a year or two. So, you know, and digging up results from like when North Idaho College hosted, I think in like 2007 or 2008. Yeah, there was a website, but that web address has since changed, and you get 404 errors all the time when you Google stuff like that. So yeah, it's been an exercise in, you know, I guess, educational situations. I don't know how to exactly describe it, because there has been some futility and there has been some like holy crap moments. I think, you know, one of those holy crap moments when you pull up the notes is one of these things I did trot out on one of the episodes of the show is where is it? One of the closest junior college race was 3 points. Now, yeah. There was also one that I believe it was in 68 or 1969. I'll just drop this one for you. Two Olympians tangled in the finals in 1969, with Canada's Harry Garris representing Joliet Junior College, which recently reinstated its program.
Chris Taylor?
Yep, wrestled Chris Taylor of Muskegon in the finals at what was Unlimited. So Garris went to wrestle at Oklahoma State. Taylor went to wrestle at Iowa State. So
oh my gosh.
They met in the junior college finals. Harry was already on the Olympic team in 68 for Canada. He's an Olympian, and then I'm wrestling in the junior college nationals the next year.
My gosh.
And then wrestling Chris Taylor, you know, so it was just pretty cool. You know, Noel Loban, for example, is another
Clemson.
Olympic medalist. Yeah, yeah. Clemson. He was a NJCAA champion at what was then Farmingdale State, a.k.a. SUNY Farmingdale. It's also been known as Farmingdale A&T back in the day. Gosh. So,
but yeah, I know you really just enjoy doing that. Stats kind of are your thing, but I tell you, it is important work and it's historic work. So I would just encourage you to keep going. And you know, it's just really incredible what you've done in that way. So, you know, keep it up.
I geek out over this stuff, man. It's just like, I mean, this is before my time. I didn't really start getting into wrestling. I mean, I didn't see a wrestling match until I was, you know, 15 years old ever. So, you know, people are talking about all these great matches from the early 90s. And I'm like, well, like, I mean, even in the early 90s, I really wasn't aware of what was going on. So, you know, my knowledge kind of begins at 1997 with the colleges and then the major high schools. And I'm kind of backtracking through and I'm seeing what's cool is I'm seeing names of parents that, you know, like the Orndorff brothers who wrestled at Utah Valley, you know, their dad, Dave, wrestled back in the day. And it was one of those things where he'd email me periodically when his kids were in high school but with some information. I never once mentioned that he was like, you know, an All-American or anything like that. You know, it's just things like that coming across names that like, oh wow, I didn't realize so-and-so wrestled here, or oh, wow, man, I haven't seen that name in a while. So there's some cool things you see, and you start kind of piecing other people's backgrounds together. And what I really like is when people don't – when you don't know they were an All-American or something. I was in Rio when I was in the Olympics. I was me and a buddy, Eric Sanders, he wrestled at North Dakota State, and we're out doing a little bit of a tour of the local establishments and trying to find some local beverages and such. And this guy, Clay Holly, shoots me a note on Twitter, and he's like, yeah, you want to hang out? You know, we're down here at this place called the Mud Bug. We're Oklahoma State fans. I'm like, yeah, that's fine. So we come out, and, you know, then about a year later, I'm digging through these archives, and there I see national champion from Adams State, Division II, Clay Holly. Clay, I see him later. I'm like, Clay, you never said you were a national champ. I mean, just those type of things to me are just one of the coolest things about wrestling is discovering somebody you know and somebody you become friends with, and you know, they don't even mention one of the larger athletic experiences that they've had. Oh, yeah, I was a national champ. A lot of people lead with that. No, yeah, not everybody, apparently. Yeah.
So let's talk about the Fargo Almanac a bit here. The email popped up a week or so ago with a 2019 update, and there went about 2 hours of finding something that I needed, and then followed by a bunch of personal interest walks to different things, and you'll see a name, and then you'll trace his history in it. And so talk a little bit about the Almanac, and if people haven't gotten a hold of it yet, how they can do that.
I've actually made it really easy now. There's no longer a super long URL or go to FargoAlmanac.com. That's the immediate purchase page. And what it is it's a digital guide that has every single All-American from every single state association that's ever competed in the event. And it, contrary to popular opinion or popular belief, it wasn't always in Fargo. So, I mean, we call it the Fargo Almanac because it's been there since, you know, the mid-90s. So we're looking, this will be my 21st year. I don't really feel like I'm old enough to have covered anything for over 20 years. But yeah, this is my 21st year coming up at the event. And it really started years ago. It's like, well, who are the All-Americans? And, you know, I got this question constantly. And then I basically dug and with some different resources that were out there, like Mike Chapman's Encyclopedia of American Wrestling, that really got me started. And then when I worked at USA Wrestling, digging through old amateur wrestling news is digging through old, you know, USA Wrestler magazines, Gary's office of bind, Gary Abbott's office with bound or three ring binders or press releases from the early 90s, piecing results together. And eventually now we got to the internet age. I could, you know, just copy and upload each year. So what the Almanac is it's a historical resource that has each state also has a breakout of their first champ or their first All-American, their most recent, how many medals they've got per style. You know, all sorts of different breakouts, and each state has its own little section, which is one thing that's been the most popular with, you know, like the state chairman or such, because sometimes there's somebody new comes in, the website goes away, and the records are lost. So in coming up with that, it's not something I make a whole lot of money on, but it's something that I feel like I've got the information, people want the information, I'll put it out there. And it's $20 one time, and that's the one thing that is probably one of the best things about it is I'm not going to charge you $20 a year for the results that you could just go get off Flow Arena for it. I'm not going to say, well, you need to buy a new one each year. No, you buy it once, you get updates for life for free. So that's one thing. It's like it's $20 and you get that access to stuff that's, you know, it's the only place it's ever been published is here. So yeah, you get kind of an exclusive deal on this. I'm probably not the smartest business guy in the world if I'm selling something like this for just $20 one time. So, you know, it's one of those things, like I put it together, I print up a couple copies that are not for sale, but I'll bring them to the to Nationals, and, you know, I'll hand one over to Flo, I'll hand one over to USA Wrestling, so they have these things, and, you know, I'll hand some stuff to Sandy AL and Dort Mayab as they're announcing whenever there's relevant things. Like, one of these things that I love looking for is if a state's never had something, or it's been decades since somebody's won something. Those are the things I'm running a sheet over to Sandy or AL or Dort and be like, hey, this kid's going to be the first cadet Greco-Roman national champ from Tennessee or South Dakota, or the first, you know, the first women's champion from Georgia or South Carolina. You know, those type of things are like what I live for, is seeing firsts and stuff like that. So if, you know, and right now I'm the only one that's got that information. So constantly during the day, I'm, you know, through the course of the week, you know, I'll be up there at the press table and people are like, hey, do you know when? And, you know, that's kind of what I feel like I'm putting my time to use, because it took 3 or 4 years to put all this stuff together, and, you know, even updating it each year and making sure the numbers check out, and, You know, there's a lot of points of failure when you're updating one record to the next. It's, you know, I've got a lot of it automated, but I still have to do a lot of it by good old fashioned math.
Yeah, and it is good stuff. And you know, and I, you talk about printing it, and you kind of laugh about the NCAA championships fan guide. You know, it's not something that you want to print because it's, you know, 300 pages or 250 pages or whatever. And so I took the Fargo Almanac this year, and I thought, okay, I'm just going to print the stuff that's pertinent to Kansas. So while I'm following the tournament, you know, I can look things up and see where we're at. Well, 17 pages later, you know, it's just, you know, there's information upon information. And I think a couple of neat little additives too are you have historically what the weight classes have been. And then again, you talk about where the locations for the cadet and junior nationals have been too. So I think those little additive things besides just the stats are really important too. It's just, again, very, very well done.
One thing I've also thrown in there is the, I don't want to say correlation versus causation, but you look at how many of the Division I All-Americans competed in Fargo. So I've got a breakout of how many of those were champs, place winners, or just competed. And you see it's that number's, you know, I think it's about 77% last time I looked of the Division I All-Americans that competed. Then I also went to the further divisions, Division II, Division III, the NAIA, how many of those All-Americans placed, you know, or competed. I think I can get better, you know, getting the kids that competed is kind of tough, even though because sometimes you got kids that go 0-2 in Fargo. And, you know, next thing you know, they're in the lineup at Hastings College or something like that. And you're like, you know, that's not a name that'll jump out at you. But like, oh, they competed there. So. But with the WCWA and the NAIA women, we've got those breakouts now because they've got, you know, years of data to go through. So it's and I've also got, you know, entry numbers. So we're about, I mean, last year, the total number of entries was 4,999. That, oh, so close, yeah, to that 5,000 mark. So there's quite literally, and I, now my next thing is, again, glutton for punishment. I'm going to go back and try to see if I can find at least the medal match results, because I actually had somebody go, well, if it doesn't have the brackets, I'm not interested. Who in the world has the – you know how big that that would be? Because back in the day, I mean, Fargo brackets would be 150 guys deep.
Oh, yeah, for the champion, those brackets would roll onto the floor.
Comparing, I mean, it's like one weight class is three pieces of paper times 40 years times 17 weights in cadet. It's just – that would be – I mean, literally would be of biblical proportions. It might actually be bigger than the Bible. So, no, there is no plans of trying to get every single bracket ever. If I can find them, that would be great. If you are listening to this show and you have brackets from Fargo you would like to send, or Cedar Rapids or Warrensburg or Iowa City that you would like to send my way, I will take them off your hands. I will probably scan them and digitize them so I can then do something with them later. But let's just say I'm about to do some renovations here in the basement. And the point is to downsize the amount of paper and boxes I have in here, not to increase it. So if you have anything that you think is legitimate out there that I could find useful for my historical status, please, by all means, send it to me. I'll take a look at it. So, I mean, I got boxes of stuff I still need to pour through that was dropped off here by various people who pass away, and their widows send it on to me or to Amateur Wrestling News, and it ends up in my lap somehow. So it's always interesting to find. But, yeah, again, the next thing, as I was going to say, the glutton for punishment, I'm going to look up at least try to find all the medal matches as best I can so we can at least have results from the medal matches. And that's something that's going to be very tough to track down. But, you know, I'm not even 40 yet. I think I got time for this.
Okay. So you've risen the ranks quickly over the years on the mic, you know, culminating with being in the Olympics, the D1 tournament, but you still hang on to, for example, like you say, you're coming to the NAI tournament in Kansas this spring. The D3 tournament's always one you are always excited about. What is it about those other events that maybe aren't the most high profile event that are compelling to you and keep you coming back year after year?
They are high profile. I mean, to tell the kid, the NAIA, that he's going for a national championship, that his event is not high profile. It's high profile to him. It's high profile to the coaches that are out there trying to win national titles. High profile, it's all in the eye of the beholder. You know, does it move the needle nationally? Maybe not. But is it important? Is it high profile to those athletes competing? It absolutely is. So one thing, I went to my first Division III championship in 2009. I actually saw the junior colleges a week prior to that, but it was really the 2009 Division IIIs in Cedar Rapids where I really got to see college wrestling outside of, you know, what we see with the Big Ten, the Big 12, the power conferences. I saw it for the non-scholarship guys. The guys are, I mean, it's like you see some familiar names out there. You're like, oh, that guy wrestled at Michigan State, or oh, there's a guy that transferred from Iowa State. You see some of those D1 transfers, but again, the misconception is that these lower divisions are populated by guys who are D1 washouts. That's just not the case. Some people just make different moves academically. Some people want to stay close to home. Somebody might want a small liberal arts degree. Somebody might want to, you know, have wrestling as a job and be able to have a degree so they could go home and, you know, work on the farm or something. There's just so many different aspects that make these divisions fun, and they're all based on competition. They are unpredictable. And as a, you know, I was a sports fan before I was a wrestling fan. So when you get into, you know, I want to compare it to the NCAA basketball tournament for a second. When that 16 seed or that 15 seed beats the one or the two, that gets everybody talking. That is exciting. So part of it too is the upsets. You know, when somebody who's not supposed to win beats that top seed, and that seems to be more prevalent in the lower divisions where it's chaos, it is unpredictable, and you just kind of get sucked in to, I guess, the drama of it all. You might not have, you know, ESPN telling you a storyline about why this is great, but you know, there are some things I've seen in Division III that are just amazing. And then when you get the opportunity to announce and you know, call a national championship. You know, I had the opportunity to start announcing the NAIs, the Division IIIs, and the Division Ones the same year. So 2016, I got the opportunity to call 30 kids national champions. That's something that, you know, and I popped the same way. So last year when Sawyer Miller from Indiana Tech, you know, won a national championship, I don't know what came to me. It's Miller time, and you know national champion. You know, I called it the exact same way that I call, you know, Spencer Lee winning a national title, you know, in Pittsburgh this year. So I want to make sure that even though that the division doesn't, you know, Division to me doesn't matter in terms of the effort that I'm putting into it. Now, Division I tournament is a monster event. You spend a lot of time on it. I put a preview guide out for it that's, you know, like I said, 300 pages deep. It's a lot, you know, it's a lot of notoriety there. There's, you know, 18,000-19,000 people. But I want the wrestlers to know that every wrestler that's taken that leap, something I never did as an athlete. I never wrestled at the next level. I was barely I wasn't even a good high school wrestler. I wasn't even a mediocre high school wrestler. So when I see these guys going out there and these women going out there and doing something they love, a lot of the times they're paying to do it. A lot of the times they're non-scholarship. They're maybe getting books or something. So the competition is infectious. So when I see the banter between a Montana State Northern and a Southern Oregon at the tournament, or I see people, you know, all right, you know, Grandview's now the evil empire in the NAIA, or when I see Wartburg and Augsburg tangling, and you see a new program like Johnson and Wales, or a new program to the upper echelon like a Johnson and Wales come in and contend for a title, or a couple years ago Elmhurst and Steve Marinetti had a really, really good squad that took second. You know, Joe Rao is a world teamer. He wrestled Division III. So the opportunity to wrestle should never be overlooked, because it's where your high school coaches are coming from, your educators, the people that are sitting there listening to this show. How many of you guys were Division I All-Americans? Probably not as many as the guys that were room guys or, you know, starters at a D2, a D3, or an NAIA type of school. Those are the people who love the sport and want to get back to it and start coaching. That's where our coaching pipeline comes from. So, you know, if you look around the high school ranks in this country, I guarantee you not every single high school coach was a Division I wrestler. And, you know, even the ones that might have been, not even the best ones, make the best high school coaches. So, I mean, you get – and those are the coaches that get people to fall in love with the sport, and they talk some kind of chunky kid into coming out. And, you know, 20-some years later, he's announcing the Olympics. I mean, that's the type of coaches that are born out of, you know, not being elite wrestlers. They just love the sport. So a little bit of my own story in there, and I'm getting into a long diatribe about why. It's all connected to me. Like – you know, to see the kid from Grandview, to see the first All-American a couple years ago from Ottawa place. I mean, those are big moments for those schools that are taking the chance of adding wrestling. And it's, you know, as a wrestling advocate, you want to see schools have success. You want to see the Wachita Baptists you know, win a trophy. You want to see, you know, the Williams Baptist pick up national champions and things like that. You know, it's those are stories that are good for the sport, regardless of what level of competition these guys are competing in.
All right. Well said. Well said. So
I don't know how much you could make of that. I was going all over the place. I'm just trying to keep myself focused here.
That was good. So with that said, you know, and you've traveled far and wide, all the different divisions, what four or five wrestling events would you recommend that people put on their bucket list to attend?
Well, the annually, see, because you got to put the Olympics on there, but that's once every 4 years. So I kind of make that an asterisk. But the World Championships, without a doubt, seeing, you know, we are so, I guess, insulated a lot of ways. You know, a lot of the anti-freestyle crowd, they don't see it enough. They don't understand the rest of the world because, again, we don't do the metric system. You know, we have gallons. We don't, you know, things of that nature. You know, kilograms and meters don't make sense to a lot of us unless we're swimmers or track runners. But, you know, go over there and you see the absolute cheering that you see the Turks and the Azeris and the Iranians. There's like, you know, you don't go to Carver Hawkeye and watch a college dual meet and have 50-year-old men arm in arm singing. It's like a giant soccer game, you know, overseas. It's that kind of atmosphere. You know, I think, you know, the American wrestling fan needs to see that, needs to understand the reverence that the rest of the world has for the sport. You know, we're so, you know, we've got some bravado about, you know, how good we are and we like our folk style and, oh, it's about control. Like, nobody gives a crap about riding time outside of the 49 states that have, you know, sanctioned wrestling. And I even think that some of the high schools don't even care about riding. I hate riding time. But I mean, like, it's just like, really go over and see it. So the World Championships is up there. The Division I Championships, because it is a experience. It is an event. And this year coming up, there is a lot more opportunities for people to get tickets because it's going to be in a cavernous U.S. Bank Stadium, home of the Minnesota Vikings. I think the NCAA is looking at maybe capping that around 45,000. The place seats around 67, but they're not going to sell. They're not going to put people up in the, you know, up near the bullhorn or whatever the heck the Vikings have. I'm not a Vikings fan, so I don't even know. I haven't been in the building yet. But there's an opportunity now for, you know, 20 to 25,000 new fans to come to the Division I Championships for the first time. And, you know, people are going to complain about sight lines. You're going to complain. Wrestling people are going to complain about anything just to complain. You know that. You're a coach. You've heard every complaint in the book. So, you know, you get past that. You go for the event. You go for the party. You know, a lot of the people that have been going for 40 years, they started going when college kids could afford to go because these events were on college campuses. Now you're going to have an opportunity to get some inexpensive tickets. So this is really an opportunity for a lot of college kids to go for the first time and really create that atmosphere. I've got a group of buddies that started going when they were working with me at Intermat, you know, 15 years ago, and now they get a suite every year. It's their, you know, their weekend away from their wives and kids, and, you know, they have a good old time. Some of them a little bit more fun than others, but it's, you know, it's an event. So, you know, wrestling's a social type of atmosphere. So that's two. The Division III championships are absolutely for the same reason. You will see things that you will not expect. You know, every year a one seed goes down the first round, it almost seems. I think we might have not had it this year. I know we had it last year in Cleveland on back-to-back mats. The number one seed at 125 and the number one seed at 133 went down. Back-to-back. And it's not like they were just bad seats. These guys were hammers, returning All-Americans, and get upended. That type of stuff throws a number one and number two seed met in the consolations this year in Roanoke, now that I'm thinking about it. We had, the top seed, you know, top seed gets tacked, you know, in a pre-quarter. I mean, it's like, what? We had a returning national champion go 0-2.
Wow.
Like, that's Division III, man. Division III. So the other two are bucket list because they hold a special place in my heart. Fargo, because to see how a 23, 24 mat circus runs, and it is one of those opportunities where you can go to a Buffalo Wild Wings and you can sit down, and next thing you know, you could be having lunch next to John Smith or Kendall Cross or Alan Freed, or you could be sitting there and be like, oh, wow, isn't that guy who's wrestled for, yeah, his kid's wrestling now. There's so many different people. You can sit there and run into having a beer, having dinner at the mall, you know, just sitting in the stands. There is, I mean, it is like, and the thing is, it's not a super spectator packed event. It's not like you've got thousands of spectators to try to, you know, get around. So you got thousands of kids, because it's a giant wrestling tournament. But Fargo, it's not the most fan friendly in terms of trying to cover it. Like, you are not going to go through that bracket with a handwritten bracket and try to follow it. Ain't going to happen. You have literally 100 bouts finishing every 10 minutes. Think about that for a second.
Wow.
You've got maybe 300 bouts at your average tournament. You've got that many ending every hour, 2 hours. It's crazy. It's nuts how fast they can farm through things. And finally, I guess, Virginia Duels has always been, it was the tournament that got me into wrestling. So while I wouldn't know if it's a bucket list item for fans, it's a bucket list item because you want to see how a dual meet tournament should operate. I mean, Ed Aliverti, the late great Olympic announcer, was the voice of that for many years. Ken Berger, who is another announcer, he announced the Olympics in 2012 in London, who I've worked with as well. I mean, we've had, a great soundtrack. You know who's wrestling on every mat at every time. It is got the best hospitality room in the country. It's the birthplace of the college of the dual meet advancement tournament. You know, the National Duels was founded out of that event, and it's, you know, for me, it's home. So for me, it's definitely, it's an annual bucket list thing, if that makes any sense. That's my Christmas. I always joke that, when I go to the Virginia Duels, one, I don't hear my real name, and two, it takes me an hour to go to the bathroom, because by the time I get off the head table, I'm stopping, I'm seeing teammates, I'm seeing coaches, I'm seeing people I've covered there, because, I lived in Virginia for 25 years. There's a lot of people I know there. So it's a homecoming of sorts. So those are my, five plus the Olympics, because I really believe once, I've been to two now, and I'm working on, I don't know if I'm still in line, trying to figure out if Tokyo is in the cards for me. I've let it be known that I'd love to do it again, but they don't make that decision for a while. But, seeing those events, you got to really, I think it opens up your eyes to the world of wrestling beyond what you know. And I think that's always a good thing. If you're a Division I wrestling fan and you like, you're a Penn State follower, or you like Oklahoma State and you don't know much else about it, you pay attention to your high school team and maybe a college team. If there's so much information out there that you can become an international wrestling fan, you can be a fan of our superstars. It makes no sense that the highest level of our sport has the least amount of attendance. So, I mean, it's like the opposite of professional sports. It's strange, or the fact that there's very little crossover between high school fans and college fans, and even lesser crossover between college fans and international senior level fans. So, I remember growing up in Virginia, I couldn't name a single starter at any college team in the state of Virginia. Now, you got the opportunity to know every single starter and follow them on social media and interact with them, and then, see them in life. That's the reason we've got attendance with over 24 Division I teams averaging more than 1,000 people. That's directly a result of the information available. Now, if we can get everybody to be a fan of the sport, not just a fan of their particular portion of the sport, because how many high school basketball fans know nothing about college basketball? No, you're going to know something about college basketball if you're a high school basketball fan, right?
Sure,
typically, yeah. Wrestling is so, we've got that disconnect that I'd love to be able to bridge that gap one day. And I'm not sure what it's going to take, but those are my speaking points on it.
All right, so you mentioned your countdown to Norsalton, the Little Rock series. You've did some creative things with doing the open mic at the Asian Games. You did interviews with officials. How do you come up with these new and creative ideas? And do you have anything in the works that you could tell us about?
Well, I am working on something, and I've gotten the go-ahead through Amateur Wrestling News to archive, I guess, in some ways, the columns that the late Don Sayenga had penned for Amateur Wrestling News called The Oldest Sport. And Don was he was, I believe, in his 90s. He just recently passed away. He was fighting cancer for a while. Don was basically me well before there was me. And he was a lot better than me because he actually did it the hard way. He was a traveling salesman. And he would, on these sales trips, he would go to the library, these local libraries, and he would look up information about wrestling. And he'd get the librarian, who, as he said, it was so eager to help anybody that would come in. And he would just collect all the stuff. And he wrote columns about this and the history. He goes back and talks about wrestling at the turn of the century, talks about the first Big Ten championships, which was then it was called the Western Conference. So many different stories that Don outlined and wrote for Amateur Wrestling News that are not available anywhere unless you actually have the hard copy of the magazine. So with his permission, I had him on the show before he passed about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And with John Hoke's permission, I am going to narrate the Oldest Sport columns. And because I have every Amateur Wrestling News I believe, from 1956 to 2006. So I think he started writing those in like 63, and I think he finished them in somewhere in the 90s. So there's like, you know, there's a good 100 or so of these things that you can sit there and narrate. And the only reason, only place they are is in these magazines. And there's people that don't even have any idea that some of these great stories were written. So that's one thing. I want to be able to chronicle things that have never happened before. I want to be able to do a series on the death of SEC wrestling and the death of black college wrestling and what happened. You know, I'm going to take short time, my main show, and to do more journalistic features where it's not just, okay, here's an interview, you know, start, stop, and go. Like, you know, I've sent two requests to Pat Dye, who is the old athletic director and football coach at Auburn, who is fingers pointed him as being one of the culprits on the demise of SEC wrestling. He's still alive at 79 years old. The other guy who is the culprit, I can't talk to because Bear Bryant died years ago. So I at least want to at least come out and document and get stories told about why Florida doesn't have wrestling, why Auburn doesn't have wrestling, why what happened to Alabama. So those things, as I grow older and get these times to break down these historical pieces. And I thought about it the other day. I've got a list as I pull up. I keep lists for everything, which is not surprising, I think, anybody that knows me. But I have 147 different people I want to interview, like right now. And the question is do I get to them? You know, I mean, I'm working on sitting down with Jay Robinson, but I'm also working on sitting down with, you know, for my Minnesota show, which is for the Guillotine, not Minnesota University of, but rather the publication here, the Guillotine. You know, Mary Christensen White has been basically the backbone of that Minnesota wrestling program for decades. Nobody knows who she is. She's basically runs that office. You know, she's was Jay's assistant for a long time. I don't want to call her secretary because she's so much more than that. You know, getting a story about her, you know, I'm about to go to Fargo. We're going to talk to Steve Saxland, who is a co-owner of Herd and Horns, which is a place where everybody starts to go now. Him and Todd Fuller were three-time champs at North Dakota State, you know, and they're co-owners of this restaurant that's super popular in Fargo with football and wrestlers. So, I mean, there's all the MMA people. I mean, there's so many stories. I mean, I think it's probably going to be an hour and a half worth of just telling you who I want on the show and why I want to have them. So, there's so many things that run through my brain about what I want to do and what I want to document. And this medium of podcasting is great for that because, you know, I've got the opportunity to just put it together. And if it's a 5-episode series, it's a 5-episode series. I also got a pro wrestling arc that I want to go through with people that are from our world and then have gone on to into sports entertainment. So there's a number of those people. I know that there was a guy who was a wrestler that was, you know, on the last season of Survivor. You know, he's a TV anchor down in Georgia somewhere, trying to get him to say okay to an interview. He's got to clear it with CBS, but, you know, crickets on that one right now. So as far as ideas go, you know, the referee, when you brought up Laura Conway, she's an official. She pitched an idea. I was like, yeah, sure. So, I mean, I usually will try anything if it works. If it sticks, you throw it to the wall, see what happens. You know, I've gone through a couple different iterations of Short Time since I've had it. And, you know, we're over 500 and some episodes there. And, you know, this week in Fargo, I'm going to probably have more mini episodes where it's 5-10 minutes with somebody. But I have a theme this year. I'm going to go out there and I want to have a little sign right there in front of the media table. It's like, tell me your best Fargo story. And I just want people to just tell me a memory they have, if it's 5 minutes or if it's 15 minutes. You know, tell me about the time you saw Mark Jane bombed on his head by Harry Lester in 50 seconds. Tell me about the time, you know, Alan Freed lost a pool match and ended up still coming back and winning the tournament because the bracketing was different back then. You know, stuff like that. Tell me those stories. So if you're there in Fargo, you got a story to tell. Come find me. I want to hear it.
Okay. So, you know, with all that said, I mean, it's tiring listening to you, all the things you've got going. You know, just personally, what drives you? What keeps you going? What, you know, similar to an athlete that just, beyond getting that gold medal or the recognition, just internally, you know, wants to be his best. Is that similar to what you have?
You know, it's one of it is kind of being or having the opportunity to educate, because coming from a newspaper background, I worked at a daily newspaper for 8 years and fact checking. You know, we're in an era where fact checking really doesn't matter, because you can put anything on social media and, you know, the loudest person in the room usually gets all the clicks. They get the attention. That doesn't mean it's right. So there's a discussion right now, and I'm going to use this as an example. The Open Mat and Bryce Villa did a piece that was what if the Division II, or how would the Division II champions have fared in this year's
Division I? Yes, I chimed in on that one. Yeah.
Now, and it's, and what he, now for those who are scoffing at that right away, no, he is not saying would, he doesn't say champ versus champ. He's saying what would this year's champions, how could they have done at the Division I tournament? I don't know if he's, I mean, yeah, there's some pitch about what happened back in the 80s and 90s and even before that with Hasselrig, but there was like, oh yeah, and then it comes into a discussion about, oh, well, back in the day, you know, D2, D3, NAI, and junior college, they all used to qualify. No, they didn't. They did not. That is factually incorrect. So it's one of those things like the NAIA athletes that competed at the NCAA championships, this was also before, there was really before a split of Division II, Division III, and Division I. Well, those schools were dual affiliates, and that was really common within small college programs, because like Lock Haven and all the Pennsylvania State Athletic Conference schools were usually dual affiliates between the NCAA and the smaller colleges and the NAIA. So you weren't just winning the NAIA tournament and qualifying for the NCAA tournament. That's not the case. Gray Simons, for example, won the NAIA tournament and then they qualified to go. Well, actually, even then they didn't qualify because the NCAA championships and the university division was open until like 1971, I believe. So we're looking, or it might have been 68 through 71. Freshman eligible 68. Okay, it might have been open 71. I know I'm mixing my dates here, but again, that the misconception goes around. You say a myth so many times it becomes truth. Well, no. I want to be able to help people get their facts right. I want people to understand that there is a value on history. There is a value on knowing where we came from. We have people that don't think wrestling existed before flow wrestling. I mean, that's kind of what we're dealing with here with some of our, you know, I mean, I guess it's my kids' generation, so to speak. I mean, what's great is we have kids growing up now that didn't know that there was never access to results and video. So, it's a great time to be a wrestler and a fan right now. But again, the world didn't begin with the internet in terms of, you know, wrestling results. So being able to say, no, there was this guy, you know, when Brandon Womack from Cornell, well, he's believed to be the first Alabama native. No, he's not. I can tell you this. So it's again, getting the history right. It's just, who else is going to do it? I guess it's not like I'm doing it out of necessity, but part of me is if I have an access to help the sport do something or correct something or be more accurate and get a better degree of, you know, legitimacy, if we don't have our records, what does ESPN say? Hey, who's this? I mean, I remember there was an issue last year with, or 2 years ago, you know, we're trying to figure out what the win streak was as Zane Rutherford was approaching, you know, almost 100 wins. And, you know, Lee Kemp was questioning, you know, where his win streak. Well, back then there were ties and matches that were counted differently today or counted, you know, they counted, you know, back in the 70s, they wouldn't count today, but you can't go back and change that. You can't go back and say, well, that loss doesn't count now, so we can't count it now. No, it's just, you know, so there's issues with our history. So part of that on my historical side is wanting to be able to have a reference point and be able to answer those questions. What do I get out of it? I don't know. Glutton for punishment. I mean, I love the sport so much. And I love being able to provide something that people find useful, whether they pay for it or not. You know, I prefer, you know, if you want to buy the almanac, please do so. You know, you want to support the network, please do so. Because again, most of my stuff's listener supported. I mean, I have paid clients that are teams, but you know, to be able to do something that puts my strengths on display, it keeps me fresh. You know, every time I'm talking on a microphone, I don't get stale, and being able to just educate and, you know, just provide knowledge, that's kind of a driving force. And there's that degree of accomplishment when you do something. And I left the newspaper business because I got tired of, you know, I could bust my rear end and nobody knew it. And yeah, there's a little bit of like, I'm not going to say that I'm not doing this because I don't want, I don't care for the recognition. No, I definitely want people to know this is what I'm doing. But I also don't want it to seem like I'm not doing this just for recognition, because there are better things to do and less labor intensive things to do if you're just looking for name recognition. Trust me, working as an archivist or a historian in wrestling is not the best way to get your name out there. You know, it's one of those things that, again, you're kind of a glutton for punishment, but it's just like, there's a degree of satisfaction when you complete a task that's never been done before. I mean, that's like, it's like putting all these stats together. Nobody's ever done it. Nobody's ever done it. And now it's there for the sport. And a lot of the stuff gets donated to the Hall of Fame. They reference me all the time. They're like, hey, Jason, do you know when we can do this? And then boom, there we have it. It's helped me understand how to use SQL databases. I'm not a super tech guy. It might strike people as a surprise, but no, I'm not super techy. I learned something. I taught myself HTML. I taught myself, you know, how to use, you know, robust spreadsheets beyond just like tabulating things in a table. Like, I mean, VLOOKUPs, and then we're looking at MySQL databases and, you know, podcast technology and RSS feeds. There's so much stuff that I didn't go to school for this. Figured that on my mm-hmm. own. So like I said, there's a lot of easier ways to get notoriety or recognition for things. But I feel like when you complete a project that's never been done before and you see people get benefit out of it, that's kind of where like the smile hits. It's like that person is directly benefiting from the work I did. And I kind of like that. It's, I don't want it to sound cocky or egotistical, but you know, people want to have their work appreciated, you know, just like, you know, some coaches don't want the credit, but behind the scenes, they're celebrating with their people behind the scenes. I'm not celebrating, you know, I've got the best guide in the world in Fargo. I'm not on the microphone saying I'm the best announcer the world's ever seen. I'm not on social proclaiming my greatness. So, I try to keep my head down in that regards, and I promote my stuff a little bit, but you know, I really feel like if people get something out of it, it's worth doing.
All right. So besides Press Row at the Fargo Dome, where can fans catch up with you if they're in town for the Nationals?
That's a loaded question if I've ever heard one. usually it's one of a couple places. For lunch, you're going to usually find me at the Buffalo Wild Wings across the street because that's where everybody goes. Afterwards, you can also find me Herd and Horns, which is a spot, like I mentioned earlier. They've been real good to the show and the program. That's over on 12th Avenue South. I think it's 12th Avenue South or 12th. It's 12th Avenue South into campus. Of course, the Turf, which people know, I've had a mug that is now of legal drinking age. That mug turns 21 this year. And of course, I'm a craft beer snob. You know that. So I'm going to be floating around and trying to find a couple different spots. I know that, you know, Labby's down the street, actually is not a craft beer place by any means, but it does have some good stuff on draft. I know there's, couple different places, Fargo Brewing and Drecker and, you know, maybe Junkyard over in Moorhead. I'll find my way out to over the course of the 8 days.
All right. Well, thank you again for taking the time to join us and good luck with Fargo and everything after.
It is a marathon, not a sprint. Fargo, the only place in the world you're going to be like, what time is it? And people go, Wednesday.
This has been Patrick Kelly with Airtime, the official podcast to the Olympic Styles of USA Wrestling Kansas. Until next time, thanks for listening.